get started, if anyone is sitting in the back and would rather be sitting up front, there are these seats over here, and they're not open for any reason. I'm just going to say a few quick things about logistics, and then we'll get started with the first panel. My name is Andrew Woods. I'm a fellow at the Human Rights Program, and I put together this workshop with the help of people at the Kennedy School, Berkman Center, and the Human Rights Program. Last night, as I was thinking about how today's going to go down, I was toying with the idea of scrapping all the panels all together and announcing a day-long workshop on the reproductive cycle of the common fruit fly. And then I was thinking you'd come in and I would say, April Fools! And everyone would laugh and then we'd start an actual conference on the reproductive cycle of the fruit fly, which would be the real joke. But I decided that would be too awkward. But we'll have a little awkwardness, which is really good, as I'll explain in just a sec. So we are being videoed. Basically, don't say anything stupid, by which I only mean don't reveal classified state secrets, because when this is over, we will email you and say, please tell your friends about that video that contains the classified state secrets you weren't supposed to reveal. A quick word of thanks to everyone who helped put this together. Mike and Annie at HRP, Colin and Amr at the Berkman Center, David Laser and Marshall Gans at the Kennedy School, and then Marshall Page at the Provost's Office, all contributed time, energy, and in some cases money to put this together, and I really appreciate it. Quick note about the aims of the conference. This conference began when I had a meeting with Colin in the fall, and we said, wow, we have so many interests in common. We surely should collaborate on something, but what will it look like? And here we are today. And if you sort of hovered above the conference, you'd see a number of things immediately that would spark, for a lot of you, associations. You'd see Berkman and HRP working together, which might mean you see, oh yeah, okay, so geeks and activists, people on the one hand who work with social networks or networks generally, and people on the other hand who deal with social movements and social justice, and you see academics and practitioners. But then if you sort of zoomed in, maybe down to 15,000 feet, you'd see the lines would blur a little bit. The people that you saw working with networks and you maybe had assumed they were with Berkman were actually with the Human Rights Program or were writing a dissertation about human rights movements in Latin America, and were just as concerned with networks or the use of computers that are networked as they are with social movements. And in the same way, they might be academics just as much as they are practitioners. And just off the top of my head, Marshall Gans is the perfect example of that. He's a leading figure in the social movements academy, but also has worked on the ground to lead social movements. And we'll talk later today about his experience working with the Obama campaign, where there was a real, in some cases, clash, but also conjuncture between social networks approach and narrative-driven social movements approach to organizing. So at the top, you see vague attributes about identities of the people who are here today. And then zooming in a little bit, things get a little bit more blurry, the lines get muddled. And then at the ground level, you have actual full-fledged individuals with identities who are talking to each other and talking on panels, and that's where things get a little awkward. And you might think, wow, that doesn't really make sense, or that panel could be really strange because those people speak completely different languages. And it won't be as awkward as a day-long conference on the sexual cycles of fruit flies with this crowd, but it will be a little bit awkward, and I actually think that's a good thing because that awkwardness means that we're in the space of interdisciplinary work. So I just want to say two kinds of interdisciplinary work, right? One, between the various different disciplines in which you guys all work, but also between people who are hardcore practitioners and people who are hardcore academics. And I want, that relates to the next point, which is there really, really, really are no dumb questions. And so hopefully you will feel free to speak up. If someone says something in a jargon that you don't understand, just speak up, say, can you clarify that? Because the idea for this workshop, as you see from just looking at the agenda, is to go both from looking just at networks to looking at networks and movements, and then looking at on-the-ground movements today, and also moving from pure theory or mostly theory and to, or empirical work, but academic to actual on-the-ground practice today. Related to there are no dumb questions, it's funny, I have here listed no dumb questions, which sounds like a command instead of a statement. We have this question tool, which I sent out, and if anyone is online right now, you can go to cyber.law.harvard.edu/questions/HLS-SOC networks, S-O-C networks, and feel free, we'll have, I guess, Amr, will we have it projected up here, or will it just be for people who are on the site?
I mean, when there are people presenting.
So whenever someone isn't presenting, we'll have the question tool up here. And the way it works, it's very simple. Someone proposes a question, you look at the questions, see one you like. If it's something you also want to hear the answer to, you click it, give it a vote, and they get aggregated and sent up to the top. And we'll try to use that to address some of the questions that people might have but don't want to vocalize, or that they just have halfway through a presentation and don't want to forget. As we said in the email last night, there are a number of tools. Like, there will be an IRC channel. The link is in that email. If anyone doesn't have the link, come see me or come see Amr. And then same, if you're going to be blogging this or tweeting it, please use the hashtag HLS-SOC networks. Same tag. And the last thing is, is there anyone in the room who would be comfortable being a note taker? Is anyone going to be here the whole day and typing and would be happy?
Or maybe easier to do it by sessions.
Or if you want to do one session, we will send. You can just send it to. Your notes won't go out into the world unfiltered. We'll take a look at them and if you send them to us, and then we'll just put them all together so that we have a transcript of the events. Is anyone comfortable with any of the sessions being a note taker? I will be the note taker. Thank you, Andrew. That is it. I think that's it. So let's get started. And the first panel, which will be about the properties of network power and chaired by David Laser.
Thank you, Andrew. Let me just adjust the sound here. I'm going to stand so those of you in the back can see me. Can you hear me okay in the back? All right. And if at some point I sort of fade back, and you can't hear me, just gesture me in some fashion. So I want to thank Andrew. I think actually the idea of doing this was an inspired one, and he's put together actually quite an interesting heterogeneous set of people. So I look forward to seeing all the discussions and your own contributions to the day. In evaluating sort of my mandate, you know, I was staying up late last night working on this talk, saying, okay, well, can I have this sort of wonderfully pithy statement on structures and properties of network power? And after a few hours sitting in front of my computer with a PowerPoint, I decided the answer was no. What I decided to do was to begin with sort of some definitions to lay out some basic ideas, and those the definitions I'll provide will be certainly contestable, so feel free to do that in discussion, and some of my panelists as well. And then I'm going to move forward through a set of loosely connected and substantially contradictory set of statements about networks, all of which I think have some truth to them. And if I'm successful, I'll leave you all productively confused at the end. So if you're scratching your head at the end, I know I've done something right. So let me begin with some definitions. And I guess I'll begin with the definition of network. I'll give a crude definition, which can be refined, but basically the idea when we talk about networks, we're talking about a set of units, and if we're talking about social networks, we're talking about people or organizations and the like, and a set of attachments among those units, and we could be thinking those attachments and those units could be any of a set of things. We could be talking about non-governmental organizations and how they're connected, or we could be talking about people in a room, and we could imagine drawing, taking the people in this room and saying who's friends with whom, or at least who knows whom, right? I could only name, you know, a fraction of the people in this room, and I imagine the same is true for each of you. So what does that picture tell us? Does that tell us something meaningful? And I think that this has been rather different from the way the social sciences have traditionally looked at social phenomena. This isn't uniformly true because these ideas around networks and social movements and thinking about how we're interconnected in various ways have certainly had a robust following for many decades, especially since I think the 1940s is where 1930s I think is where network ideas really find their roots in a sort of modern recognizable form. But that a lot of the social sciences begin with assumptions about how we are, how we can assume independence among our observations, which is a useful starting point methodologically, but often a rotten paradigm for understanding human behavior. And often I think our theoretical paradigms have been captive to our methodological paradigms. And I think that we've begun in looking at social phenomena in the last decade, especially, we've really seen a beginning of a shift of the paradigm. So that's where I'll start with the idea of networks, and we'll see where it takes us through the day. The second question is power, and what would be a sort of good 10-second definition of power? I'm going to resist sort of going deeply there, because one could spend a career talking about power and definitions of power. But I guess I'll just rest with sort of the canonical authoritative distribution of resources within some collective. And again, we'll just take that as a crude starting point, and we'll see where it takes us during the day, and we'll modify that as we go. So when we start to think about networks and power, how do these things interplay? How are they connected? And I'll begin with thinking about this at two levels. One is the individual level, and one is the collective level. And at the individual level, we might think about how where you are in the network affects your access to resources. Do you know the right people? I've done this work on, let's say, interest groups, and how does power flow from access to people who have power over policy? Right, that would be an example of how one unit in the system might be able to get things it wants because it's connected to other units. We might also think about it in a systemic way. How does the network in a system affect collective action, affect the capacity of individuals or groups with shared interests to mobilize towards some common goal? And I think that's probably where it's in the latter. We'll probably spend a bit more of today's discussion vis-a-vis thinking about social movements and how do networks enable or inhibit the emergence of certain social movements. We see the mobilization of certain types of interests in society towards certain goals, and we don't see the mobilization of other kinds of interests. Or we might see the mobilization of some interests at some points in time and not at other points in time. How does the whole network idea help enable us to think about collective action, right? This is one of the core things one should think about in politics, and both as a student and a practitioner of politics. So I think that both of those matter. Probably today's focus will be more on this latter. So now I'm going to begin with sort of my set of loosely connected statements, and somewhat contradictory. I think that there's sort of a long run and a short run view of networks when we think about who's connected to whom. In the short run, I think networks are sort of given. There are certain, if we think of if we think of, let's say, someone running for office, or someone who has a particular political goal, and they say, we want to get people going around something, that there's something to be said about just looking at the landscape of who's connected with whom, and what is the raw material that provides for mobilizing people around something. And in the short run, you can't fundamentally change those patterns of connections within society. And so when we think about social movements in the short run, I think we're really thinking about what we're going to have happen today. Then it's really about who's connected to whom today. But in the longer run, and I think the longer run is in recent years has actually become shorter and shorter, in part because of technology, and I'll be getting to technology a little later. The whole goal of social movements, or many social movements, is around transforming the basis on which we organize, transforming our networks, transforming society, and so we need to think of the network as something that is both a constraint, but it's also something that is acted upon, and that those constraints evolve over time, and that maybe I think those timescales are getting shorter. So let me talk about a little bit briefly about how position in the network matters. This is a picture of Cosimo Medici. There's a wonderful paper by sociologist John Paget talking about the rise of the Medici in the 15th century in Florence. And he traced, there are these wonderful data, and he's a genius, by the way. Anyone who comes up with the idea of research that requires extensive sort of years upon years of fieldwork in Florence is a genius. And he gathered all these archival data on transactions among the Florentine elite families and who was married to whom. And he found that the Medici, over the years, and it wasn't really so planned, had emerged in a uniquely central position in the network of families, in part because they were willing on the commercial side to transact with everyone, so they were well networked with some of the nouveau riche, who some of the old families would not have economic transactions with, and yet they also maintained a lot of marital ties to the old elite, and it put them in this privileged central position in the network, whereas the anti-Medici faction, ironically, the opposition to the Medici had a denser network, which you'd say, well, a denser network should help facilitate mobilization of action. But in fact, what happened was that it actually prevented the emergence of a clear leader within the network, so the Medici were better able to mobilize their families and their coalition as compared to the anti-Medici. So the insight here is in part that where you are in the network matters in terms of your capacity to mobilize others. And the Medici, in this particular case, were in a privileged position, but also that matters, that the structure of the network matters where you are, both from a collective and individual point of view, again moving across levels of thinking individual and collective, that the Medici faction was able to mobilize better because it was more centralized. And so, which again supports the intuition that it's not merely having more connections that helps you mobilize, but the pattern of connection actually matters. And this was a case where more connections actually inhibited mobilization or affected mobilization. But timing, as in comedy, also matters. And this is something that I think is often left out of network ideas, because often we think of these networks as sort of these people or nodes that are connected through these edges and these sort of really cool pictures. But that is something I'll get to in a minute, can be a somewhat inaccurate picture. That, for example, in research on deliberation in small groups, it's clear that when you talk matters, and the people who talk first actually have more influence over things than people who talk later in a group. And so it's not just where you are, but it's when you speak up that can actually affect, especially when we're talking about issues around framing and structuring the discourse, that this actually matters as well. The network is bottom up in the sense that it's not centrally centrally planned. This is a version of, it's a little blurry actually. I just pulled these things off the internet, but this is a version of, there's this wonderful book by Tom Schelling called Micro Motives and Macro Behavior, from written in the 1970s, which is really about the emergence of networks, or part about the emergence of networks. And he talks about, for example, how segregation can emerge from mild preferences to being with people who are like yourself, that is, not wanting to be in a small minority in your immediate neighborhood, can lead to a system which is hyper-segregated. He did it on a checkers board, but it works just as well on a Go set, I think. So in a fundamental sense, if we think of agents in people with, thinking about where you sit, say that you all chose certain places to sit in this room, and yet I'm sure that there may be certain types of systemic patterns that emerge from how you chose to sit, and that's this idea of that the processes are bottom up and self organized and emergent. If I can get all the buzz terms into one sentence, and so that I think is an important intuition. However, the network is also top down, right? And it actually frustrates me when people talk about networks and emergence and self organization. Stop where I was a moment ago and say it's all about self-organization, because we know that their design really matters for networks. I have pictures here, of the office building. I think this was some office building in Australia, but it doesn't really matter. But we know that having a corner office is helpful, say, in terms of power in the office. Because it gives you more information and more connections. We know there's studies that look at how much people communicate actually within offices, and it turns out that communication drops off even within office space exponentially with distance. You're just vastly more likely to talk to the person in the office next to you than the person two offices down. And then if you talk three or four offices down, I don't even know what their names are, right? I mean, so space really matters. We can think of this vis-a-vis things like subway systems, right? And it always strikes me like the Boston area, for example, how mass transit has sort of structured proximity so that when I was looking for a house, there are places that are sort of equally spatially distanced from Harvard Square, some of which it's a real pain. Of course, driving anywhere in Boston is a real pain. But some of which, in terms of mass transit, you can get into Harvard Square very quickly, and others, the same distance can take three times as long. This is done by design. There was a plan, there was a thought about how to design things. We see this, with respect to the organization, this formal organization of organizations. The organizational chart also maps in significant part to the social networks, and certainly every organization I've looked at, while the informal networks don't align perfectly at all with the organization, that there actually is, actually most of the variation, or much of the variation in the networks, map onto formal organizational boundaries. I'm sure if we looked at Harvard, for example, we would find just exactly how powerful boundaries are in terms of determining who talks with whom. Highways are another example of architecture that unites and divides. Here we have a map and redlining, which clearly, I talked a moment ago about segregation being a bottom-up process, which in part it is, but very clearly, if we look at the history of this country, there were very clear top-down policies as well that drove segregation. So we know that we can intervene in ways that powerfully affect networks, and so there is a sort of top, very important top-down process And I want to note, and I suspect the Obama campaign might come up a few times today, that there were both powerful bottom-up and top-down processes. This was not just sort of an organic thing that wasn't channeled in any way. It was very carefully built, constrained, and mobilized in very particular ways. And so there were both aspects when we think about the Obama campaign. But I also want to note that even when you design systems, networks have unintended consequences. And this is a little characterization of the internet. And the internet was originally designed to, or at least the forebears of the internet was designed to facilitate collaboration among academics. I mean, in fact, it's been quite successful at that, I think. But I don't think that's the first thing anyone puts on the list when you talk about the impact of the internet over the last decade. So there's been these incredible unintended consequences from building this infrastructure, this physical network to facilitate interaction, and so I think this is evidence of a much broader rule that when you design things, when you put together the top down and the bottom up, it's very difficult to anticipate many of the consequences. You can anticipate some of them, but there are an awful lot that you cannot. Networks generally are slow changing structures. We think about who you're close friends with. This is something as I've gotten older, I realize that you can only have some. You can't get old friends very quickly. It takes time to develop a history with someone. It's something I didn't quite appreciate when I was in my 20s, because hadn't been around that long, and now I've been around for substantially longer. Something I recognize, that having a daughter who will be going off to college in a year, and thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I have a teenager. And you realize that sort of these networks are very slow changing. And it depends, again, what kinds of networks you're talking about, but in terms of deep relationships, that these are things that change, but they evolve glacially, right? So that's one picture of a network that you should have in mind, but it's not the full picture of the network. I'll also give you another picture of the network. Let's see if this actually works. This is not working, but I think this is worth, no sound. Just take a moment. It's interesting. It's provocative enough or evocative enough to, yes, there we go. And let me pause this for a moment so I can explain what it is. This is based on research I'm doing with some folks at the Media Lab, Sandy Pentland and Amol Madan. It has involved circulating mobile phones to a set of people in a dormitory, which tracks their physical proximity over the year. So we know who is within 5 meters of whom for 9 months. All, by the way, with informed consent and so on went through. So don't worry at least too much about that for now. But this shows what I'm going to show you is a week's worth of proximity among the 75 or so participants in this study. And in part, it includes, by the way, the time during the Obama-McCain debate. The size of the node indicates how politically interested they are, and the color of the node indicates whether they're Democrats or Republicans, blues or Democrats, reds or Republican. And the edges indicate physical proximity. The edges are black, indicates that's during the daytime. If they're red, red eye indicates that it's at night or early in the morning. And so this will give you a sense of the interactions during this period of time. Explain what I just said. And so we see sort of this dance of interactions. And in this sense, these things around these proximities are really quite fleeting. and they may be quite consequential, right, in the sense that, unfortunately, we don't, from a research point of view, unfortunately, we don't know what they're talking about from a privacy point of view just as well. But you know, they're having conversations here, some of which might be politically quite consequential. Oh, that's right. Well, I'm not quite that paranoid yet, but
nodes and edges are just people who might not be familiar with.
Okay, I'm sorry. The nodes. Thank you, David. The nodes are people. These dots are people. Nodes are the individual, the units. The nodes are individuals or groups, and that are being connected. And so the edges are just simply the lines here, indicating physical proximity. And so what we have here, let's say this blue person is over here, is someone who has lots of political interest, a person 30, and they're a Democrat. And you can see, that they're, occasionally getting and interacting in groups. Now these may be groups to talk, have dinner together or what have you. But these kinds of connections are also the basis on which social movements are made, I would argue, because people are talking about politics. They are talking about, oh, do you want to go up and canvass in New Hampshire for Obama? There is a bit of a blue tinge, you'll see, to the distribution here. In other cases, they'll be saying things, do you want to go out to a movie together? But, there are a lot of things going on in this network, and one of the things we're studying is how political views evolve over time. Political mobilization evolves over time, and how that connects to interactive behavior, and how, for example, I'm not sure whether we saw this already, but there's a moment here during the debate, for example, do you see people mobilizing around particular political events? But, this picture is quite different from that slow-changing sort of network picture that I just gave you. They are both, I think, appropriate ways of thinking about networks, but they're quite different ways of thinking about networks, and probably it's useful to have both in mind for this discussion. So I'm just going to maximize this again. There we go. I also want to emphasize networks predate Facebook. They go back to what we are as human beings, right? It was before we talked about collective action for political purposes. We were talking about collective action so that we could sort of get food and survive. And we're built to be social animals, and in part that's one of the things that both facilitates collective action, but it's also in part what one of the sort of distinctive features we've evolved to survive and thrive. And this is just a picture of a portion of my Facebook page, where you can see, sort of a standard academic picture, Harvard, MIT, that's, New York, Boston, my various techie political science friends, my network friends here, and so on. But I want to emphasize, technology is an enabler, but not a driver of networks. And what do I mean by this? Technology may facilitate certain types of connections, may facilitate certain types of communication, but that doesn't mean that if you build it, they will come, right? I'll give you an example from my own research. We've done this massive study looking at how members of Congress use the internet in various ways. And every member of Congress has an official website. And so our idea, coming from sort of deliberative theory and so on, is like this was an opportunity for a consultative relationship between members and their constituents. They could explain why they took the political actions they did, inform their citizens, and so on. Well, actually, when we talk to communications directors in these offices and the like, that wasn't their view. They weren't thinking about the deliberative potential of the internet. They were thinking about how can the internet make their member look good. And so, just as an example, and I'll pick on someone who's no longer a member, but Deborah Price, and she's not so atypical. You can see this is a picture of her homepage. And then you look at Deborah's views, and she actually doesn't have so many views.
And, you know, and that's a little unfair to pick on her, because also she wasn't running for re-election, so she actually had somewhat fewer views than the modal member. But actually, for I'd say, a very large number of members of Congress, it's hard to even figure out what political party they belong to, based on their official website. That there's a real fear of making clear where you stand on the issues, because you might alienate people in the process. The internet doesn't really distinguish, isn't a very good mechanism for differentiating message. So you can't say, well, here's the message, click here if you're pro-abortion, click here if you're anti-abortion, right? You can do this with letters, you can do this with email, you can target your message or tailor your message to some extent. You cannot do that with the internet. You can only present one face to the world. And furthermore, it creates this permanent record of where you stand. Some members actually, their staff say, we pull everything, all the press releases and the like, down off of the website every month. We put them up and then we take them down because we're afraid that opposition research will use these press releases from years ago. And I don't say anything, well, you know, you know about the Internet Archive, because you know that's all getting grabbed anyhow, so don't bother taking it down, because then they just wouldn't put it up ever anyhow, so it wouldn't really improve matters. But there is this almost this fear of transparency in a way, and, you know, much as we talk about sort of there's a lot of press on members of Congress twittering like during the State of the Union and so on, but that's not really. You know, I don't know how much that really has lived up so today to sort of discursive ideals either. So let me conclude with three metaphors for networks. My students in the room will don't have to listen to this. Well, actually, there's one new metaphor I developed. The one is thinking about networks as a regulatory system. I mean, circulatory system rather. And one is as a regulatory system, and then finally as a catalytic system. And when we think about networks as a circulatory system, we can think about how things flow through networks. I tell someone something, they tell someone something, the same thing, something, you know, and it spreads through the network. And that's one metaphor, I think, that captures what networks do. A second metaphor is how networks provide opportunities or constrain behavior. So we can think of concerns of reputation. There's really the whole field of economic sociology really is largely built on this sort of regulatory metaphor that we behave better with friends or with people with whom we have shared third-party ties because we're afraid of the consequences beyond this one transaction. That if I behave badly with Andrew, he'll tell other people, and then that will adversely affect me. And so that's a second metaphor to think of, is sort of how networks constrain behavior. Maybe under certain circumstances, you're not constrained. And the third is as a sort of a catalytic system, where we think about how different people bring different things together. I've done a lot of stuff on problem solving, for example, and we think of how different people might have different parts of the answer and how we recombine this. This is actually a picture from work that Cesar Hidalgo and Ricardo Hausman, a colleague of mine, have done, looking at products that have been that Malaysia produces, and this is looking over time and from 85 to 2000. And the idea here is what you're putting together in one year. How does that facilitate new things that you might put together? And we can think of networks as sort of acting upon themselves. Changing their capacities over time, and I think that's also a pretty powerful metaphor for thinking about what networks do. So in any case, my objective here has been to thoroughly confuse you. So I hope I've been successful, and I'll leave it to the rest of my panel to unconfuse you. But in any case, I appreciate you. You know, sitting here, not making faces while I was talking. So, thank you. And we should, I think, shift pretty quickly to the next person, and then we'll, I think, really focus on Q&A at the end. So,
David, do you have a PowerPoint?
No, I don't, no.
Would you mind going next and then as soon as we get the imagery issues, we'll do it afterwards, but it may pop up and then we'll turn it off.
Okay, no problem. No problem. So, take
it from here, David.
Okay. All right. Try to ignore the technical problems over there. Using a notepad suffers problems of personal incoherence, but not technological problems. So please excuse the former. I hope that some of you, in listening to this very helpful introduction by David Laser, felt a little bit like Molière's Monsieur Jourdain, who found he was delighted to find that he'd been speaking prose his whole life without knowing it. And I hope that there's a sense in which social movements and people who are practitioners have an intuitive gut-level sense of some of these dynamics. I know that the day will move into considering problems for people who are in social movements and are concerned about social justice problems. And I want to, you know, put that front and center in some ways for this discussion, and also want to, you know, encourage people to ask academics like us to try to make relevant some of these findings for particular dynamics that you're facing. So I'm going to try and direct my comments to that question to some extent, but I'm also happy to get into a broader range of discussion about some of the theoretical issues. So I'm coming at the question of networks from a slightly different perspective than social network analysis, which are these sort of formal mappings that David Laser was just talking about. I come more from social theory and a concern with globalization. And the sort of network power that I want to focus on briefly here is not so much, it's related to, but it can't be reduced necessarily to positionality in a network. Rather, it has to do more with the power of standards when multiple standards come into competition. And it borrows more from the idea of network effects, the literature in industrial urbanization and economics that discuss how technical interrelatedness in goods can lead to one good overtaking another. And I think that insight, core insight, can be generalized. So that's enough of the sort of academic stuff. Let me try and sketch this out concretely. If you think about globalization, I think, and you think about the rise of transnational networks in everything from language, where everybody's speaking English, to new forms of technology, where people are linked up using all sorts of new protocols and technical standards, to the rise of certain currencies that have power even outside their domestic arena, I think that all these phenomena can be understood as network phenomena. And I think that what we might want to think about is what happens when networks that are based on different sorts of standards come into contact. And I think that might be a way of thinking about how networks have power. So again, I want to distinguish between the power that you get if you're analyzing an existing network, like the Medici in the network of nobility in Quattrocento Florence, and the kind of power that you might say the English language has to draw in people who don't already speak English but want access to people who do. And these are related concepts, but they're slightly distinct, and so I don't want to minimize some of the differences there. So I think that we can start with this idea of network effects. So what's a network effect? Do people have a sense of this, or network externalities? There's a literature in a whole series of literatures that talk about the way in which something has value with reference to the audience of other people who are doing something in a similar way. So the more people who use a given convention, who speak the same language, who rely on a particular kind of technical good, the more valuable it may be for others to use that same technical good, to speak that same language, or to do something in that same way. And where you get this idea of network effects, you can have networks that grow in a way. And I think that's maybe one interesting thing for social movements to think about, is the way in which they can tap into some of these dynamics of what I call network power. Again, a slightly distinct sense. So I think the idea of network power joins up two ideas. The first is that Standards grow in relation to the size of the network that they help to coordinate. Again, standards can be considered very broadly. Any of the forms of linkages that David showed may or may not have an underlying standard. What I think I mean by a standard is not simply that people are linked up in a particular way, but they're linked up in a way that renders them mutually comprehensible, comparable, or allows them to engage in some kind of beneficial activity. Again, think about language. Language provides a very obvious example here. So what network power is then is the power that standards have to grow by drawing in outsiders into a network based on the underlying standard. And one effect that network power can have is it can edge out alternative ways of doing the same thing. So in my book on globalization, I focus a lot on how the rise to dominance of certain transnational standards in, say, language can have the effect of sometimes edging out alternative ways of doing the same thing, and I try and think about the politics of globalization as a fight among different standards. But I'm going to put that argument to one side, but you can see how the rise to dominance of a standard underlying a transnational network can be a good thing or can be a bad thing. It's going to depend on who you are and what you're looking for out of any particular direction. So broadly speaking, on this view, we should understand that networks are sort of accretions of voluntarism, if you will. They form out of voluntary activities of people to connect up with others using some particular standard. So again, this is different. If you want to do a social network analysis mapping, you can map any social group, from family through to a state. You could map prisons. You could map anything. And if you tried to figure out how people were interrelated, you could use these advanced tools of topology to show what's going on. What I'm interested in is rather networks in the sense that I think are more familiar from social movements, which is where people join up into a network, right? So I think we can see networks everywhere, but I'm talking about now in this more limited form of networks, say related to transnationalism or to social movements, where people are becoming part of the network, like Facebook rather than say Congress. We can describe Congress as a network, but it doesn't have the same feel as a network as something like Facebook. And I think that what's going on there is this aspect of the voluntary nature of the social dynamics driving it. This relates broadly in political theory literature to two ways in which we can imagine consent, or the way in which people join up with something. And this is an older vocabulary that I try to resuscitate somewhat, but it's a distinction between sociability and sovereignty, or sociability, or social networking, if you will, and politics, where in sociability you have a person-by-person consent to join up with a given network, right? You can choose to be part of Facebook, or you can choose not to be. You can choose to learn English as an immigrant to this country, or you can choose not to. And the costs and benefits for doing these things may very well determine how you come down on those issues. Whereas in politics, you have an initial group consensus on a decision rule, which then allows you to bind everybody in the group. Now, the reason why I want to develop that distinction is to talk about one worry I have about using transnational networks in solving social problems. And I'll just throw this out as a concern or a question I have, and it'd be fun to come back to this if people find it interesting later in the day. It's that if we think about networks as these accretions of voluntarism, the kind of problem that a social movement wants to take on will matter a lot in determining whether or not a network will be an effective means of organizing around that problem. Now, that probably is totally obvious, as I was saying, to people who have been speaking prose their whole lives. But let me try and get a little bit more distinct about it. If the problem that a social movement is facing is the problem of holdouts, particular bad actors, then certain kinds of network forms are going to be relatively inefficacious. Whereas if the problem that you're dealing with is a systemic problem that is based in a norm or practice that's embedded in the people who are part of the network, then I think various forms of network power may be more effective in trying to solve the problem. So to give an example here, if the relevant people in the network are doing things that are environmentally unsustainable and are susceptible to various forms of persuasion or peer-to-peer networking, you can imagine, as we've seen with various social movements that focus on consumer boycotts and so on, that you can have an effect by mobilizing networks as part of your strategy. And in that case, I think all the forms of mapping and all the forms of careful thinking about who's positioned where and how you get timing and so on to work for your strategy are going to be very helpful. If, on the other hand, you're dealing with particular bad actors who aren't joined up in the network, the network strategies are going to have to be, I think, part of a broader political strategy. The reason for that is that networks have a problem with enforcement in a way that states or ordinary politics don't. So for example, suppose you're dealing with problems of human trafficking, and you know, and you're going up against a network of human traffickers. Is a network going to be effective against them? Well, they're not probably part of the same activity. What you need is an enforcement, the ability to bring law, for example, to bear on the particular activities of those individuals. Forming a network to deal with that would only be part of the, I think, the strategy of gaining the traction in ordinary politics to use politics to break up that network. This is a somewhat maybe complicated issue, but the problem, again, is that networks, I think, don't have in themselves the capacity, without engaging broader politics, to enforce their norms on people who don't want to connect up with them. And I think that that's a fundamental weakness of any kind of transnational networks dealing with the problem of bad actors. Now, again, I want to distinguish that from a case where there's an ongoing transnational practice that's internal to the network that can be transformed by reconceptualizing or reshaping the network. So again, I think that there's a general problem between what we might call normative force and enforcement, where enforcement, you really do need to rely on something like police power and law versus normative force. And I wouldn't want to have that critical distinction elided, because I think one thing that I hear a lot from friends who are dealing with human rights issues and so on is there's a great deal of interest in networks. And sometimes where the rubber hits the road in terms of enforcement against bad actors, I don't hear them having a clear sense of how all of their network is going to do that. So again, I wanted to direct these comments toward the sort of social movement end of things. I'm very happy to talk about the more theoretical issues of network power, network effects, and so on. But I'll leave that maybe for the Q&A and see what motivates people. Thank you.
But that's actually a good thing that there were some technical difficulties, because I think David's talk just now is a good lead in to my own work in a way that I think I sort of triangulate both David's interests. So the title of my talk is NGO Structure, Network Power, and Human Rights Norms. I did not turn on the show, sorry about that. Okay, there you go. I wanted to thank Andrew for asking me to speak here today, and also to David for a great introduction, so that I don't have to deal with a lot of the technical stuff, although I will talk a little bit about more networky things, just so what I'm saying makes more sense. And what I'm going to talk about today comes out of both my own research and also a paper, actually it's now a chapter in an edited volume, with Professor David Lake. Shameless self-promotion, it's called Networked Politics. It's out on Cornell University Press as of today. So if you're interested, please check it out. So I'm going to be putting together a lot of stuff in hopefully a condensed and understandable format. And any questions, because it doesn't make any sense, if I talk about it in 15 minutes, I'm expecting a good conversation. So hopefully people find this interesting. Before I start, I want to do a little bit of terminology, because I know this is an interdisciplinary meeting today, and so some of the stuff I say on a daily basis that makes sense to me and to people who study human rights in particular might not make sense to any of you. And one of the things that David was bringing up was this idea of standards. And in international relations, which is my specialty in political science, we usually call those norms. Standards and norms are the same thing, essentially, but we refer to them as norms. Norms are basically a standard of behavior for a given identity. Okay, so whether you're a state or an NGO, a non-governmental organization, which is what I focus on in my research, or you know, you're an intergovernmental organization, norms are what determine what's good and bad for that type of actor. So what a state should do, good state should do, what a bad state would do, and how we think about good and bad in different actors. When I talk about networks, and this is sort of a disciplinary specific comment, but I want to put it out there because there are a lot of people in international relations who actually study networks, not in the way that David talked about in his introduction, which is basically my understanding, you're looking at different actors and the quality and quantity of connections between them, what we call edges or vertices. But there are some people who want to identify networks as opposed to organizations, okay, or individuals or states. They want to perceive them as separate political phenomena. And I specifically do not want to do that. Okay? I specifically want to talk about organizations, NGOs, as networks. And so that's something I want to make clear. It is a particularly controversial point among some of my colleagues, and so I want to put it out there in case any of you are international relations people and are wondering why I'm talking about networks, or sorry, NGOs as networks, okay, when they're clearly different things. And I want to say that they're the same. Or that we can look at organizations as a form of network. And finally, human rights. I think it's a very broadly conceived category. This is my issue area of particular interest in a lot of my research. And so because human rights is a normative and a very loaded term, I usually think of it as stated in the major international documents we have out there about human rights. So I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was signed in 1948, and then the two sort of accompanying international covenants on civil and political rights, and then economic, social, and cultural rights. And this has been called by some as the International Bill of Human Rights. I don't know to what extent I agree with that, but those are the three documents I'm looking at when I think about human rights. It's quite actually a broad way to think about the concept, and that leads me to some of my research questions. I want to talk a little bit about basic assumptions about what I think is going on in terms of how NGOs and networks go together. So I think that both Davids talked about how politics can define networks, right, defining how networks work. But I also want to say that politics is a product of networks. So networks not only act and function according to political compromises within them, but also they produce political outcomes. Okay? They also operate based on a lot of common understandings or standards or norms, but they can in turn produce those types of standards or norms, as David talked about before me. Now, what I think social network theory can do is actually help us understand why it is that various human rights NGOs are more or less successful in changing those norms. Okay, so what the political outcomes that many human rights NGOs are seeking, out of those, there are only a few that are successful. And by successful, I mean have helped shape the way we think about human rights. Okay, so why is it that some human rights NGOs have been able to put their imprint more clearly or more boldly on international politics, whereas others who are also advocating for human rights don't seem to have the same sort of normative power? Okay, so that's how I think about power in terms of ideational power. The synthesis of this is that the organizational structure of an NGO, the way that the network of the NGO is structured, is going to determine the extent to which an NGO can influence international human rights norms. And I argue that when you centralize agenda setting and rulemaking power, and I hope this becomes clear as I talk more, you're going to have NGOs that are more likely to influence international norms of human rights. In other words, what I do in my work is I look at power within networks, okay, to understand how networks have power, right? The power of networks. So looking at internal structures to understand the impact of NGOs on international politics. So it's a very, if you want to boil it down, it's a pretty simple argument. Okay? NGOs that are structured as scale-free, and I put this in quotes because it's not entirely correct to say that, but I say that anyway, are more influential in changing international human rights norms. And what I mean by scale-free, again, that's in quotes, I'll explain why, are NGOs that rely upon a grassroots base, a grassroots advocacy base, so lots and lots of people are part of this NGO. But at the same time, only very few persons or parts of the NGO have a real say in what goes on in the NGO. Okay, so there's not a whole lot of argumentation at the decision-making level. Right? There might be debate, A lot of NGOs are very democratic, so they have lots of discussions, but at the end of the day, who decides what the NGO and the rest of its membership does and how it thinks about human rights is located in a very specific body. Okay? So our basic argument is that if your NGO looks like this, then you're going to be more likely to be able to influence international human rights norms. All right, just a little bit of background information about human rights more specifically. The UDHR I mentioned before, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, was signed in 1948. It's a non-binding document, but it also set the agenda for the rest of human rights politics as we know it today. A very expansive notion of human rights included lots of different rights that we've come to accept, such as the freedom from torture, for example, but also the freedom or the right to food, the right to paid holidays, the right to join a trade union. All these rights are in the UDHR. So it's a very expansive notion of human rights. But at the same time, what you see, what you observe in international politics is that there's a movement towards a certain set of human rights, despite the fact that when it was established, the notion of human rights is actually very broad. Okay, so since World War II, the focus of a lot of human rights politics, and this is especially true in the period before the Cold War ended, were these four core rights that I've put up on the slide. So the freedom from torture and arbitrary arrest, and also the freedom of expression and the freedom of religion. So that's sort of been the core focus of a lot of human rights debate. And this is not really just a West versus the rest story. A lot of times people try to characterize human rights politics as this is just simply the West, that's a Western idea, or these are Western ideals that they've imposed on other states. And what I want to argue, in fact, is that the end of the Cold War, which is when you would expect a lot more challenges to this idea, that's exactly when you see human rights becoming an expansive debate, which tries to include more notions. Okay, so why is it that during the period of the Cold War, where there were two major competing ideologies, that these sort of rights came out on top? Okay, so this is a little bit of the networky stuff. These are archetypal networks, so obviously there's ideal types. But what I want to point out here is there are three different archetypes. So you have the lattice, or the random form, okay, here, where a lot of the actors within these networks have a fair number of connections, but nobody really has a dominant set of connections, right? Everyone has roughly the same number of links to everybody else, okay? When you get to the small world network, okay, this is sort of the middle kind, what you see is that some nodes are central in these individual networks. So kind of like the picture of the Obama-McCain debates, where you had some networks that were, clustering around, right, clustering around different persons. So what you see here is, this person here has five friends, okay, and they're linked by that person to another group of people. Okay, so this is why it's called the small world network. And finally, there's the idea of a scale-free network, right, where you see all the links converging on a single node here, which you can barely see because that node is hogging all of the connections in the network. Okay, so this is important for understanding some of the structural arguments that I make about NGOs. One of the concepts that I focus on is this idea of network centrality. Okay? Network centrality is one of many ways of thinking about networks. And I concentrate on this idea because I think this is the way that we can understand differences in NGO structure and therefore their impact on human rights politics. There's more than just these three ways to think about centrality, but I sort of picked, these are the classic ways to think about centrality from a piece by Freeman, 1979. This is a seminal work on how to think about networks and, more importantly, network centrality. And he thinks about it in three different ways. So betweenness, degree, and closeness. Okay. So the first one is betweenness, and basically this is an idea of, does a node fall between two other nodes? And if it does, it's between. And that makes it central vis-a-vis the other two nodes. Okay, so if we flip back, for example, this node is between these two. But it is only between those two, right? So it does have a measure of betweenness, but only between those two nodes. if you look at the small world, you can see that this node is actually between several other nodes. Okay, so it has a greater degree of betweenness in the sense that it connects more nodes than this does. And if you look at the scale-free one, which is the most between, you see that this central node is actually between everybody else, right? To get to anyone else in the network, you have to go through the central node. So it's very between, all right? It has a high degree of betweenness. If you think about degree, okay, degree is the next criteria. Degree is a measure of how many nodes are adjacent to or next to you. So how many nodes are you connected to, okay? So again, we can look at these three, right? You can see that any node in this lattice or random shape network is not really connected. Well, it is connected, but only to another few nodes. And you see that it increases with the small world, right? Some nodes, again, are connected to many more than others. So, you know, this guy's not that connected, but this one is, okay? And again, scale-free, the central node is the most... has the highest degree because it's connected to everybody else. Okay? And everybody is only connected to the central node. All right. And finally, we think about closeness, right? So how close together are the nodes in a network, right? In this one, to get from one end to the other, you have to go through a lot of different steps, right? You have to go through a lot of nodes to get to some other nodes, okay? So that's a really, that's not a high degree of closeness, okay? When you get to the scale-free, you only need to take two steps to get to any one node, okay? So we see that as a centralized network. I see some eyes glazing over, so if you guys get the idea, I'm gonna go on. But the idea is that you can think about centrality in three different ways. To think about which nodes are central to a network. And so then the question is, well, why do we care? Okay, why do we care whether some nodes or some networks are more centralized than others? Why is it that the scale-free and the, you know, I went through all the lattice stuff, why does that really matter? Well, first I said that I put scale-free in quotes because you can't really, a scale-free network actually assumes an infinite population. And if we're talking about parts of an NGO, we can identify the boundaries of that organization. Right? So by definition, it's not an infinite population. But what's important about thinking about scale-free networks and looking at that picture and identifying some of the characteristics of scale-free networks is that the key thing that makes a scale-free network scale-free is that one node or few nodes has a disproportionate number of connections to everyone else. Right, so most of the other nodes in the network are connected through one node. Okay, in other words, that node is central and is linked to everyone else, and everyone else, in order to link to other people in the network or other parts of the NGO, has to go through that central node. So that central node is sort of a gatekeeper. Okay, and that's the key insight for what makes scale-free networks important, but also for my work, determining what central actor is passing on information within that NGO, okay? Okay, so before I do that, I want to think about how you build an NGO or how you build a scale-free network so that you would have this sort of centralization of power within a node. When you look at the topic of human rights advocacy, one of the first things you ask is, well, why would anyone join a network or why would anyone join an NGO to begin with? What's the incentive, right? If you care about human rights, why do you contact, you know, Amnesty International? Why would you do that? Well, there are a number of things that, if you have a centralized network, makes it appealing for you to join. Okay, first of all, there are low barriers to entry. That's one of the things that enables a scale-free network to form. Right, it's easy to join, so you can have this big grassroots base. You don't need to be a lawyer. You don't need to be a doctor. You just need to be somebody who likes human rights. And maybe you want to pay $20. Maybe you want to participate. So that's the first thing. The second is that there's this law of preferential attachment. So there's more value to joining, okay, the most central actor, the one that has the most information, that can control information, than it is to join at any other point. So you're going to want to link to a certain actor, okay? And also, joining an NGO is cheap information. And that just means that instead of you having to do all this research on human rights violations in Guatemala, some NGO probably has already done that, right? They already have all the information. You can act on it given that information. So that's what makes it appealing to join an NGO or to join a network. Now, why would you, as an NGO, want to have such a large grassroots advocacy base? Because you know that that's probably going to contribute to coordination problems. That's going to contribute to problems with you getting, you know, a unified message, right? Because the more cooks in the kitchen, the worse the soup ends up, right? So why would you want to do that? Well, the first thing you would want to do is you want to get your message out. So there's the economies of scale, right? Because once you produce that report on Guatemala, it's not that much more to have someone else read it. It's not going to cost you that much more to have someone else read it and act on it for you, right? So you want to take advantage of grassroots advocacy. And the other one is the more people who are attached to your network or to your NGO, the more likely your brand's going to build out. Okay, the more likely that other people are going to know about your NGO and the fact that you work on human rights and, you know, you do good work. And on the other hand, the better your brand, maybe the more likely you're actually going to achieve the social change you're seeking to do. Okay, so there are some advantages to creating this kind of network, even if it imposes some sort of cost on you, right? You do have more people to manage, and the more you have to manage, the harder it gets. Okay. Central nodes are more powerful than peripheral nodes, okay? And why we talk about this and why we look at the structure is that the structure matters for how information travels within your network, okay? You can control the advocacy agenda. Everyone has to go through you to get the information. If you're the one that holds all the information, you control what happens in that NGO. You also make the rules. Okay? You can make the various rules that people follow. We're not going to advocate for this person. We're going to advocate for that person for whatever reason. And finally, one of the consequences of having all the links collapsed on one node is that this is also the network's weakest point. So it's the most value added to the network, but it's also the point where if this node somehow disappeared or got taken out, the entire network would essentially fall apart. Okay, so this is sort of the structural stuff that would affect how effective a given NGO is going to be on international politics. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead and just talk very briefly about one of the cases I've worked on, but we can talk about more NGOs if you would like during the Q&A. Amnesty International, I know most of you have heard of this organization, founded in 1961, and in my analysis, exemplifies what I would think are a lot of the characteristics of scale-free networks. As you know, they built out their name through letter writing and campaigning, and part of their appeal is the accuracy of their information. They're well known for their research, and as you can see, it has a large membership base, 2.2 million members the last time I checked, in 150 countries with 80 national sections, which means it has 80 official representatives at any given international meeting. Now, what's really important to know about Amnesty International is that the two bodies I have up here, the Council, International Council and the International Executive Committee, actually have official legitimacy. Okay, they're identified in the statute as having the membership, the 2.2 million members have the official legitimacy of Amnesty. That's why Amnesty is legitimate, because it has a large grassroots base. And the International Executive Committee is sort of like the presidency, right? It executes the will of the International Council, okay? The membership, in other words. And I pointed out that there's also this International Secretariat. Okay, by statute, the International Secretariat, located in London, actually does not have a lot of official power. It's just supposed to administer. It's supposed to do what the International Executive Committee and the Council decide. Okay, so it's kind of like the bureaucracy of the organization. Now, that's all well and good, and I can talk more about this in the Q&A. Amnesty International has gone through a lot of different debates over what human rights mean, over what human rights should be and what they should stand for and what they should advocate, and all this happened at the council level. Okay, but ultimately what happened was, on a day-to-day basis, when the council wasn't meeting, it only meets every 2 years. So when the council is not in session, the international secretariat has to execute. And what ends up happening is that the international secretariat, because it provides information on various cases, it does all the research, it picks the cases, it picks the countries of focus, what happens is that it actually ends up with a lot of agenda-setting power, right? Because it picks how Amnesty International executes its plan to advocate for human rights. And they actually, the secretariat actually ends up setting a lot of rules, too. So famously, for example, the secretariat rejected the idea of adopting Nelson Mandela as a prisoner of conscience, okay, or a political prisoner, in other words. And the reason it rejected it, ultimately, was because Nelson Mandela advocated sabotage, or advocated the official sabotage of the South African government. So he, in other words, he advocated violence, and that's why he was rejected as a prisoner of conscience. And so, despite the formal authority of the other two parts of Amnesty, the International Secretariat actually has a lot of decision-making power, and decided on these four rights from the UDHR that Amnesty was going to stand for. Okay? And these are the ones I talked about earlier. So what I want to show is why this matters. Okay, why does it matter that Amnesty's picked these rights? And why does it, who cares, right? It's the internal decision of an NGO. So I'm gonna skip ahead to, so why does it matter? And this is sort of the punchline, right? Why does the internal structure of an NGO matter for international politics? When we think about human rights and, you know, what are the norms or standards of human rights, often we think about formalization. So we think about the legalization of human rights through international treaties. Okay, and that's sort of the standard way to look at it because it's a direct picture. What do states care about? If they care about human rights, they're going to sign certain types of treaties, right? So on this graph, what I have are three lines. Okay. The solid lines are indicating the ratification trends for the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights, and then the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Okay. What you should note here is that the lines converge. Okay, they converge, which means that, at least at the treaty level, states are ratifying these two sets of rights, civil and political, and economic, social, and cultural, at the same or similar rates. Okay, this dotted line is the Convention Against Torture. Again, it's now ratified at about 70%. Okay, 70% of states have ratified it. So it's a little bit lower than the other two, but nonetheless, it's a pretty high rate of ratification. So if you look at this, you actually don't know what states think is important in terms of human rights. You just know that they think human rights is important. And given the fact that they're hard to enforce, and we often don't have very good enforcement, this is actually not a very good indicator of what the standards of human rights are. So what I do in my work is look at economic sanctions. Now, sanctions are basically it's an action short of war. We think about it in terms of, okay, states really are upset about something, they want to do something, but they don't want to commit troops. So they're going to sanction one another using restricting trade and so on and so forth. So what you see in terms of economic sanctions is that, first of all, human rights don't come in as a justification until the 1960s. Okay, that's what this table is showing. And there were two in the 1960s. You see a great increase between the 1970s through the 1990s. And what I've done is looked at the percentage of those that are based on the four rights that Amnesty advocates, and in fact, they're a great majority. Depending on how you count some of the cases, the conservative estimate that I have is 65% of all economic sanctions are based on one or more Amnesty rights. And so I find that to be a much more convincing way to think about standards, right? States are willing to commit to sanctioning one another based on the rights that Amnesty has advocated. So internal structure affects to what extent Amnesty International's political agenda has affected our way of understanding human rights. So finally, lessons from this work are, states ultimately act on human rights. Okay, so there are lots of different conceptions of human rights out there, but states are ultimately the ones that act on them. And the states are the ones that can sanction one another or pass legal documents like treaties for us to understand what it is that human rights are. Okay. That doesn't mean that NGOs don't have an effect. In fact, NGOs have a lot of effect. But it depends on how they're internally organized. So those that are more centralized, that have clear agenda setters, who can make the rules, are more likely to influence how we think about human rights or other international norms than those that are not, but those that have a less centralized structure.
Damon? Damon Santola came from the other side of Cambridge to join us. Damon, by the way, will be giving an extended version of this talk as part of the seminar series I run on Monday. So if you're intrigued by what he says here, please join us
for part two.
For part two, yeah. So while we make the technological adjustments here.
Talk about diffusion social networks. This work actually starts out with my interest in collective action and the interest in how people can do behaviors that are actually quite costly at the individual level, but when they're embedded socially. People hear me in the back? Yeah? So when they're, do I need the microphone? Can we hear me in the back now? Yeah, so all right, we'll turn the mic up, yeah. So when people are socially embedded, they can be convinced to do behaviors they might not do otherwise. And so the question really that motivates this research is how does the structure or pattern of connectedness of a social network affect the ability of these behaviors to spread across it, right? There's actually a ready answer to this question in sociology from Granovetter's work on what's called the strength of weak ties. Right? So Granovetter says that ties between sort of casual acquaintances, otherwise known as affectively weak ties, can be structurally very strong because they tend to span long social distances. In contrast with strong ties between close friends, in which people tend to know their friends and friends of friends, right? So because a weak tie sort of goes outside your immediate friendship group, it actually has this structural strength that behaviors, ideas, and even diseases can spread quickly across them and saturate a population. So this idea came out in 1973.
Can you give an example of a couple of different kinds of weak ties, like my relationship with my doctor is a weak tie?
Well, Granovetter is really talking about, in that case, he's talking about jobs. Yeah. She's talking about someone you meet at a conference or someone you happen to bump into in the subway versus a close friend or relative. Right, so that's the difference between strength and weakness in sort of affect. So this idea was became a huge hit in sociology. This is probably, if not the most cited paper in sociology, it's one of the most cited papers in sociology. It's hugely important. And it was developed, this sort of concept was developed more recently by my advisor, Steve Strogatz and Duncan Watts at Cornell, in what's called the small worlds model. Right. So what they did is they basically said, we can take this idea of these sort of long distance ties across the social space and build a nice mathematical model that shows how when you introduce these shortcuts, it can greatly facilitate the acceleration of you know, diseases and information, but also of cooperation across the social network. It's very rare to find this, but actually the original intuition is articulated very clearly in the original paper. Granovetter says, whatever is to be diffused can reach a larger number of people and traverse a greater social distance when passed through weak ties rather than strong, right? And so this idea that these sort of long-distance ties facilitate diffusion has had an enormous impact outside of sociology and computer science and physics, epidemiology. The whole sort of field of network science writ large takes this as a fundamental result. But so I was interested in collective action, so I was digging around the literature, and what you actually find is that for the empirical work done on collective action, a lot of it actually tends to emphasize sort of a different kind of intuition. This is Roger Gould's work on a Paris commune, emphasizes the value of closely knit residential networks for the emergence of collective action. Also work by Peter Hedstrom and Everett Rogers emphasizes spatial networks and neighborhood effects and the spread of social norms and diffusion of innovations. So Hedstrom says, spatial properties and network densities are likely to influence considerably both the speed of a mobilization process and the success of a movement in organizing relevant populations. So what he's looking at here is the spread of the Swedish trade unions. What he finds is the more densely overlapping the communities are, the faster the unions mobilize and the more successful they are at mobilizing more people. This actually motivates kind of a theoretical tension, a sort of a puzzle. On the one hand, you have this literature, which is largely sort of formalized and mathematized, emphasizing the value of weak ties or long ties or small worlds, the diffusion of behaviors and information, whatever is to be diffused, as Brandeviter says. On the other hand, you have all this empirical work. It says, well, look, residential and spatial networks or sort of local clustering can actually facilitate the organization of social movements and even the diffusion of innovations. Right, so how do you reconcile this tension? There's actually an answer that comes from the sort of strength of weak ties, small world literature that answers this, which says, look, this is simply a problem of counterfactuals. Sure, you can go and find examples of successful social movements that took place in clustered networks, but the point is that had those networks had more long ties or more weak ties, mobilization would have succeeded as well or better, right? So this is the research I'm going to present to you today, is basically using computational models, which are appropriate for every kind of question, but for this question, they're great, right? You want to be able to take the kinds of networks that we see social movements emerging in and say, look, can we systematically change them? Can we alter them, introduce these long ties? And how does this affect the emergence of the movements or the diffusion dynamics? And what I find, quite unexpectedly, is that when social reinforcement is needed, behaviors and spread farther and faster across the clustered spatial networks than across the small worlds networks. And so the striking implication of this is that Brandeviter's claim, which, like I said, is sort of a an institutional and a foundational claim in sociology, that weak ties facilitate whatever's to be fused, is actually not generalized to a large number of behaviors that we think are interesting. Are we taking questions now?
Could you give an example of the unexpected finding, like a more concrete example?
Well, so indeed, that's the talk's going to be about this.
Oh.
Yeah. and then so what I'm going to do is get into, well, I don't think I'm going to have time, but if you come on Monday, right, I'm not going to have time to get into the empirical stuff, but what I do is I get these results, and then it raises a lot of interesting disciplinary methodological questions about how you test a result like this. As David pointed out, we can collect lots of interesting network data these days, but collecting diffusion data introduces its own kinds of problems. You need a fixed network over time, you need to study the diffusion in sort of a carefully resolved longitudinal way, and you need to know who interacts with whom and at what time. This is very difficult to collect, and so designing experiments to study this kind of thing. Using the internet, and so that's sort of relevant people at the Berkman Center. So I'm going to give a quick theoretical background to this research, talk about my findings, and then briefly gesture at some of the empirical work that I'm doing now. So some people have already talked about this a little bit. The theoretical background for this is all about social networks, but the term, you've heard a little bit of difference here today already, but it's actually broader than that. The term is really used differently by different people, so it's worthwhile to just take a second to understand how I'm using it. So originally, sort of, back in the 50s, right, when social network analysis first came around, it really was referring to an ego network. So you take an individual here, like Bob, and Bob has friends Bill, Tom, and Jeff. And what you do is you look at the characteristics of Bob and the characteristics of Bill, Tom, and Jeff, and you say, how similar or different are they? And in this way, it gives you a sense of the patterns of association that Bob has, right? And the next step was to say, well, what's important isn't just the friends that Bob has, but the friends of friends, right? And maybe there's triadic closure, there's sort of clustering in the network. And one of the important insights of Brandeviter was that if Bob is friends with Bill, and Bill is not friends with any of Bob's other friends, then Bill acts as an important source for new ideas and information into Bob's neighborhood, right? So the next step was not to just look at friends, but friends of friends, and their friends, and their friends, and so forth. This whole sort of interconnected web of social relations. And of course, we have new techniques from mathematics and physics to analyze these structures. But it's important to keep in mind that the intuition that by looking at the whole, sort of pulling back to 20,000 feet, looking at the sort of interconnected web of social relations, we can sort of get a grip on the emergence of social dynamics. This actually harkens back to Zimmel's original work, right? The idea that the sort of interconnected web of group affiliation gives a sense of how the collective behaviors emerge, right? So while the techniques are new, I think there's a core sort of sociological idea underneath this. So most recently, you've heard about this already, the small world model is probably one of the most successful models to sort of use this macro level view of a social network topology to characterize the emergence of behavior across it. I'll talk a little bit for a minute here about what these definitions mean. So this is a schematic that was used in the original paper by Steve Sturgess and Duncan Watts. So on the left-hand side of your network structure, this is a lattice. Each individual here is represented as a node, and the sort of social ties between them is an arc. So this individual here has a tie on the left here and here, so two ties on the left and two ties on the right, so they have neighborhood sizes of four. And this is a large world. So what that means is you take any two individuals, pick them at random, and say, what's the number of steps, how many handshakes do you have to go through to get between these two people? It's order of the size of the network. It's quite long. Then what they do is they systematically break some of these local neighborhood ties and introduce these sort of long ties or shortcuts across the social space. And as they do this more and more, this rewiring generates a small loop. So what this means is at this point, if you take two individuals at random and you say, what's the number of handshakes to get between them? It's order of log of the size of the network. So it's radically reduced. Right? I should point out that this doesn't imply anything about degree distribution. So a network can be small and scale-free, or large and scale-free. Those things are all possible, right? So this is sort of the network topology that they use. And just to sort of make the intuition perfectly clear, this is a little simulation model. Can everyone see these lines in the back? Yeah. So this is basically the structure we were just looking at. So individuals are represented here as nodes, and you can't see the ties here. Basically, everyone has two ties to the left and two ties to the right. So like neighborhood sizes of four, right? And the people shown as white nodes have not adopted behavior. And these two individuals known as blue nodes are sort of the early adopters or innovators who are trying to spread it. And the rules of social contagion rule. So if one of your neighbors adopts the behavior, then you in turn adopt it. So what you can see is it spreads from sort of neighborhood to neighborhood around the lattice structure and ultimately saturates the population. So what I do here is, just like in the smart world model, we break some of these local ties and rewire them, creating shortcuts across the social space. So what this does is this accelerates the diffusion process, right? Because now when a contagion hits this part of the network, it can jump across to here and keep spreading. So it creates these sort of multiple seed areas. On the right-hand side, we have abundant weak ties or sort of long ties in the social space. So what this does is it radically accelerates the diffusion process. Right now, in three time steps, the whole population is saturated because it's very easy for the contagion to jump around the network. Right, the sort of smallness of the world accelerates diffusion. All right. So the take home from the small worlds and strength of weak ties models, but also from sort of network theory writ large, is that weak ties facilitate diffusion, and small worlds are better for diffusion than large worlds. So remember, when I'm saying diffusion, I'm talking about things like mobilization and social movements, right? The spread of cooperation, things like this, as well as the diffusion of innovation and information. So my work really got motivated, as I said before, by this interest in recruitment to collective action and social movements, how people could be sort of mobilized to do things that were, you know, quite risky at an individual level. I came across this study by McAdam and Paulson. So here they're studying recruitment to Freedom Summer, collective action, right? And you see the fact that we are embedded in many relationships means that any major decision we are contemplating will likely be mediated by a significant subset of those relationships, right? So what they're pointing out is a difference between seeing a behavior and not knowing it's a possibility for me, and having enough of your friends or colleagues or contacts do the behavior that you're convinced to do it yourself, right? That difference between knowing it's out there versus being convinced to do it actually motivated a conceptual distinction which had not been made in the literature at all. Between, on the one hand, a simple contagion, like a disease, like someone sneezes on you and you sneeze on someone else, right, spreads from person to person, there's a positive probability of transmission through single contact. Or a piece of information, someone asks me the score of the game, I tell them, they tell someone else, right? In contrast with a complex contagion. So a complex contagion is a behavior that requires multiple sources of contact in order to be convinced to adopt it. Right, so I need sort of social convincement or social proof in order to sort of spread the contagion to me. So thinking about this kind of thing, I return back to the small worlds model. This is the same model we just looked at before, where we have sort of a ring lattice structure. Individuals are these nodes. They're connected to two neighbors on the left and two neighbors on the right. Again, the white nodes have not yet adopted. And these two sort of seed nodes are the innovators trying to spread the behavior. The only difference in this case is I've changed the assumption about the threshold distribution. So now people need social reinforcement from a second source in order to adopt the behavior. So what you see is it spreads as before. It spreads noticeably slower, right? Because what's going on here is everyone has to wait for that second neighbor to adopt before they'll be willing to adopt the behavior also. But ultimately, it spreads around the lattice structure and saturates the population. Now on the right-hand side, we've introduced some long ties into the network, right? We're making a small world network. And these ties should accelerate diffusion like before. It's important to keep in mind that because the diffusion of the ring lattice is slower, the baseline is slower for the complex contagion than the simple contagion, the expected gain is much greater. That's to say, the relative improvement from this baseline should be much greater once we add some long ties into that network. However, that's all that happens. What happens is it starts to spread and it hits a neighborhood where a tie has been rewired. And now there's insufficient overlap, insufficient local structure in the network to carry the behavior from neighborhood to neighborhood to sort of mobilize the sufficient social reinforcement to convince their neighbors to adopt the behavior. So see this a little bit more closely. This is a sort of an up-close view of the lattice structure. See, an individual A in A's neighborhood, two on the left and two on the right. An individual B in B's neighborhood, two on the left and two on the right. And the two in the middle, these sort of green nodes, are the overlapping neighbors, the shared friends between A and B. So what happens when you rewire the network is now A has ties far away, B has ties far away, and A and B still share a common neighbor. So information can spread between them, you can get sick from each other. But if A and A's friends are mobilizing around a behavior, there's insufficient social reinforcement to carry that over to B and B's friends, right? So these findings suggest that different kinds of networks facilitate the spread of different kinds of things. If you're interested in the spread of a piece of information or diffusion of disease, if you're doing epidemiology on a simple infectious disease, then you should absolutely worry about sort of the small worldness of a network, right? The length of these ties is going to affect the diffusion rate in a positive way. However, if you're interested in the diffusion of behavior, the mobilization of behaviors that are costly, difficult to adopt, or in some sense are potentially dangerous, then weak ties, in fact, may inhibit the diffusion, and large worlds can be better for diffusion than small worlds. So these results were published by me and my advisor, Michael Macy, in 2007 AJS. We also published a paper on Physica A, and one in Journal of Medical Sociology, sort of announcing different aspects of these results. This is sort of a footnote on this. So the Physica A paper, which is a physics journal, is a four-page paper, right? The American Journal of Sociology paper is a 45-page paper. Right, so it's an order of magnitude more stuff. And I think when I was writing this one, I thought it was just going to be like a lot of social science fluff around a four-page result. It turned out not to be the case. The amount of space we had in this paper was extremely valuable for fleshing out some of the robustness and intuitions that I think are important. So just to sort of push on a few of them, you notice the networks I was using were these sort of simple lattice networks. Why would you do that, right? Empirical social networks aren't rings, right? The reason to do that is because that's the original network that Steve Stroygatz and Duncan Watts used when they built the small world model. And so the idea is to take that model and its initial insight into diffusion, you change one assumption about it, the assumption about behavioral adoption, the need for social reinforcement. And what happens is a tremendous amount of results fall out of changing that one assumption. But then what you want to do is say, fine, maybe that's just an artifact of the model. What happens if we push on it empirically? So we introduce sort of degree distributions, we made the network scale-free, and we sort of introduce exponential tails in the distribution, all kinds of different changes in the number of friends people have. What happens is that this result, as you move from a clustered scale-free to a more randomized scale-free, actually holds up. So it's not sensitive to degree distribution. In addition, some of the things I point in the model I showed so far, in the first case, everyone had a threshold of 1, simple contagion. Second case, everyone had a threshold of 2, complex contagion, right? But of course, again, empirically, things are distributed. They're not sort of uniform like this. So we look at distributions of thresholds that were Gaussian, probabilistic thresholds, and all these kinds of robustness tests that will give you some confidence. This result isn't an artifact of this particular model. And in fact, the result holds up. So across sort of a wide range of empirically plausible conditions, the difference between simple contagions and complex contagions actually makes a huge difference in the diffusion dynamics across networks. So one of the important, I think one of the most important implications here is that the research, the empirical research that was coming out on social movements about the implications of spatial structure and residential networks isn't just a matter of counterfactuals, right? That's real. Those are real results that imply something substantive about how social networks affect diffusion. There's a nice, for people who are collective action scholars, there's a nice implication here. Adam Paulson makes this distinction between high-cost collective action versus low-cost collective action. So high-cost, or low-cost, for example, would be like mobilizing a neighborhood trash cleanup, right? That's not so difficult. You just have to show up. And it, really, that's just kind of a coordination problem. You need to know where to show up and when. So you diffuse the information, people show up, collective action problem solved. Right? So in, for that kind of problem, this, you know, the smaller the world, the more the long ties, the better the diffusion of the information, and the easier the coordination problem is to solve, right? However, if you're trying to mobilize a student protest under an oppressive regime, now all of a sudden, it's not just about the information, it's about the amount of trust and reassurance you get from people recruiting you and your belief that they're gonna show up too, right? So now having a densely knit network structure is gonna give you that kind of social confidence you need to go out and do the behavior yourself, right? So this kind of difference between low cost and high cost actually maps very nicely on this distinction between simple and complex contagions and implies something about those kinds of social networks that can be beneficial for different kinds of collective action. There are also implications for cultural integration and social order. A lot of research came out of the strength of weak ties in sociology, emphasizing the value of these long-distance ties for integrating large communities. Of course, this depends upon the nature of integration. If cultural norms require social reinforcement and pattern conditioning, then the denser the network structure, the better they're going to be for producing cultural integration. So just in sort of, I'm not going to get into empirical research here, but just to motivate it. There's a lot of empirical support for this finding, but it's worthwhile to note that's the same empirical support that motivated the finding, right? So Hetchin's work on unionization, Gould's work on the Paris Commune revolt, Adam Paulson's work on freedom summer marches, this is what got me interested in this question in the first place, right? So you want some way of saying, that's fine, that supports the result, and it's interesting to find it. But you want some way of sort of giving yourself some confidence that this result on network topology, the structure of the network, is really what we think it is. Because when you look at each of these empirical studies, you'll note that there are other things going on, right? It's empirical work, it's messy, there's lots of details, right? So Hedstrom's work, there's spatial proximity conflated with the structure of the topology. And in McAdam and Paulson's work, they actually talk about the actual affect in the ties, the strength and weakness of the ties, in addition to sort of the clustering, right? So what you want to be able to do is extract out these empirical variables and say, sure, you know, in any given empirical situation, these things will be overlapping. But to figure out which one's doing the work, well, then we can do some science, right? We can extract out each one and isolate it individually and see which one is actually most efficacious in generating these diffusion dynamics. So what I'm doing is working on isolating network topology independent of these other variables to identify how the structure of the network really affects diffusion. So I've been building experiments online, basically, creating internet worlds where I create network topologies and then embed people in them and then seed them with behaviors. And that's policy. And this is it's really not a psychology experiment, it's a sociology experiment. Because what's being controlled across conditions is the structure of the community, actually creating different topologies. The individual experience in both of these worlds is identical. So for the individual, it doesn't look different if you're in one condition or the other. But the structure of the world is different. Right? You can actually see differences in diffusion dynamics across the different worlds. And so one reason for doing this experimental study on the internet is we need large networks, because there needs to be sort of a ratio between the neighborhood and the community size, fine-grained longitudinal data, and a reproducible design. It's very exciting to me because this particular study, which I'm not going to talk about today, is focused on diffusion of health behavior, because I was a Robert Wood Johnson scholar, and they like you to focus on health, because that's what the fellowship is about. Which I think social epidemiology is interesting, but of course I think a lot of things are interesting, right? So it'd be nice to be able to take this design, this architecture is built in a very extensible way. So you can take that sort of one architecture for studying diffusion of networks and put a different front end on it and study diffusion of different kinds of behaviors, right? So I think I'll be there with time.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'll conclude with that. So this research is motivated around this empirical puzzle, the weak ties versus clustered networks affect the spread of collective action. What I find is something really surprising is that when social reinforcement is required, weak ties in small worlds, in fact, do not facilitate whatever is to be diffused. This highlights the important role of cluster spatial networks in diffusion, and also what I'm doing is developing sort of new empirical methods to test these results empirically. Thank you.
So now I guess we turn to Q&A. Andrew says we can run a little late, but I would not run later than when the food gets here. I'm not that foolish.
Do you want to start with, so we have a number of questions that have popped up on the question tool, and I was thinking David could ask a few of them that have a couple of votes to start things off, and then please, anyone, feel free to jump in and just state your name, your affiliation, and your question.
All right, and then what we'll do here as votes, you can put in votes and things will pop up and we'll go back and forth between the old-fashioned way of calling and people raising their hands, and then as things move up, and I see one moving up right now, we'll make sure that those get addressed. So the first question is from Aaron. I assume it's okay to ask people to identify themselves. This is Aaron. Excellent. Thank you. Can you say, by the way, as people ask questions, maybe if you could just briefly say where you're coming from?
Mm-hmm. I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center here and a PhD student in sociology at UC Berkeley.
Okay, I had a feeling, you know, I could see the social background in the question.
What was it that gave it away?
So let me read the question. This is the leading vote getter for Professor Lazar. By the way, I should speaking of standards, I've standardized the pronunciation of my name to Lazar. There are rather odd family reasons for that, but I occasionally correct people, but I figure in a big audience, I don't want sort of the wrong pronunciation to diffuse outward. So in any case, the question is, to the extent that formal social network modeling is a representation of pure structure, can it be used to offer anything other than a structural determinist theory of power and human relations? God, how did I guess that came from a sociologist? So, and I'll give my take on it, but this is actually, I think a question that really applies to everyone on the panel. In the way I was presenting things today, so there's an interesting question of sort of social network theory, as you might see in AJS or what have you, as compared to, let's say, how I was presenting it today, which was really thinking about as a sort of elastic structure in which agency, in which there is indeed human agency. So we might think of, is a forest fire caused by the fact that it hasn't rained for a long time and there's lots of dry underbrush and the like, versus is it caused by the fact that someone decided to throw a match into the forest? And I would view especially when we're thinking about social movements and the role of decisions that people make, and let's say the election that we just had, that there was real kindling out there politically when we think about the technology, the moment, how people are connected together. But that there was nothing inevitable about how things unfolded in the election. There were a bunch of particular decisions that were made, for example, by the Obama campaign, by other people, that created certain conditions under which, for example, that allowed Obama to win the nomination and the election. But those were preconditioned by an existing structure. I don't think the same strategy would have worked 4 years ago, or certainly 8 years ago. Now that's separate from the sort of deeper sort of conceptual question here about social network methods and formal modeling, where I think that that maybe you're right in the sense that much of the objective of social network modeling has been around coming up with the structural understandings of the pattern of things, rather than understanding where human agency fits in. In fact, much of social science is like that, right? I mean, social science generally is not around understanding human agency. That may be the field of maybe when we think about theory or ethics to a certain extent. But within, I think social science is really trying to understand the general patterns of things in which then human agency might act, right? We'd say, well, you know, if we give kids more exposure to you know, higher quality teachers, say, they'll be more likely to learn. And that's, again, a sort of structural thing that you can manipulate with public policy and intervene. That's my view of things. I don't know if the other panelists have views on it.
Can I chime in on this one, too, as a fellow sociologist? So I also like this idea of pure structure, you know, like unadulterated structure. So I think that it's true that, as sociology's discipline, we tend to, you know, the word structural is, you know, bandied about as kind of like a foundational word, right? But I also think that the network modeling stuff is fairly flexible in terms of taking into account the sort of interaction. So when I work on diffusion, right, you could certainly say everything you've done is looking on a fixed network. Clearly, it's the case that as a behavior spreads, it's going to affect who interacts with whom, right? So the very behavior that's spreading is going to affect the pattern of the network, which is in turn going to affect the behavior that's spreading, right? It's sort of a dynamic coevolution of network structure and network behaviors. And in fact, I have a couple papers on that specific question, because I think unless you start to, you know, interrogate this thing as a dynamic process, you lose a sort of meaning in terms of why the network is important, right? So I think that that's very important. In fact, it's the direction that network structure is going in, sort of from a theoretic analysis point of view.
Right, empirically speaking, right? There's always interaction between agency and structure, right? You can't look at them separately. And I think that if you look at various NGOs over over time, they've made deliberate decisions to go one way or another. So if you look at amnesty, there were deliberate decisions to structure the way that they did, even though, in, you know, sort of unintentionally, they made the Secretariat more important than they might have wanted to. But if you look at Doctors Without Borders, for example, there's a conscious decision not to centralize information for various sections to actually disagree with one another and get to arguments. Oxfam is actually moving towards a more centralized structure because they think that that's more effective for some of the things that they want to do now. So there's interplay between structures and agents, and you know, structures can change, and sometimes they change very quickly depending on the nature of the problem that an agent is tackling.
As a social theorist here.
I was going to ask, actually, David, could I amend the question before you answer it? Because in some ways, I think your book deals with this in a quite explicit way.
It deals with it directly. I didn't want to focus on my own work in this panel because I understood it to be a workshop for people interested in human rights. But if you want to take on a series of epistemological debates about social science and understanding human agency, I do have a book on this phenomenon. And in the book, I am more skeptical, I think, than some of my co-panelists about the extent to which social network analysis as an abstract tool of explanation can help us in understanding. So if social science has the ambition of explanation of behavior, we may need a set of supplementary tools to be able to get into understanding of behavior from an internal agency standpoint. This is a long debate that goes throughout the 20th century and before in some ways. I want to register a slightly skeptical note on it. Consider Bernie Madoff, to take a practical example. On December 10th, he was at the center, right, of if you map the connections of Bernie Madoff to the world of elite finance and to Palm Beach and to Aspen and all those communities, he was at the very center. He's the center node of a vast pool of very powerful people. On December 12th, he's in jail. And he's still the center of that network. In fact, his network has grown enormously. People like me, who was never invited to join his fund and didn't know the name before December 11th when he was arrested, now know about Bernie Madoff. So obviously, what I'm saying, that doesn't mean that it's not important to map these ties, but the question is, the context in which we, and the context that allows us to interpret what a tie is very central, and I don't think that social network analysis can, from within itself, generate an autonomous idea of power. It's going to have to be part of a broad package of tools that include social theory and classical sociology in making sense of what context tells us about what's important in order to not only to shape our questions, but even, I think, in terms of interpreting the results we get. I mean, that's obviously, people choose to work on the problems they do in part for affinities that are non-intellectual. And, you know, I'm not a network scientist for a whole host of reasons. But I'm interested in the results. I think they have a place in it, but I wouldn't want to think that social network analysis can motivate an understanding of power autonomously from other disciplines. I think that's probably not something that my panelists would disagree with enormously.
I would tend to agree with that. I would, in fact, accent that in the sense that I'd say that a lot of social network analysis, like if I look in the organizational field, decontextualizes too much,
right,
and tries to come up with an abstract theory, but takes it out of the context of a particular organizational context, and that's sometimes deeply troubling from a methodological point of view.
So can I chime on the other side, or do you want to move on? let me say one point.
It's a nice juicy lead-off question.
So.
There's one point that in this discussion has gone back and forth. It's from Malcolm Gladwell and Duncan Watts in a way, right? So people are familiar with this idea of the tipping point, right? So Gladwell, what he does is he harkens into some true classical sociological intuitions about opinion leaders, in terms of special people in the network, and the power they have to control the sort of outcomes for the network as a whole. It's a very reassuring intuition. As the world's more complex, there are special people we can find, and if we can just target those people, we can control massive outcomes, right? So, but what that does is it removes the discussion from the overall structure of a population in defining specific individuals. And so there's a lot of work that's actually pushed on this exact issue of who are the influentials, and suggests that, in fact, the structure of the network can do a lot more work in terms of determining collective outcomes than any given specific people in the network. And so that's it's a kind of a framing question, but I think it's a very important one to take into account because we do have new ways of thinking about these problems.
It also fits really nicely with political science work on experts and the role of experts. We've become a culture of experts. And you know, Phil Tetlock has tracked the predictions of experts in various fields over 30 or 40 years and found that they're not very good at anything. And And so, you know, just another take on how much, especially for NGOs, how many resources do you dedicate to finding the influentials or relying on one set, you know, one voice or one set of voices rather than trying to structure things in a way that would create a situation that might, on aggregate, tend to create the kinds of outcomes you want.
I mean, it might also be the case that special experts are important in the beginning, right? When you don't have a network or you have the beginnings of an idea, you need someone who's very influential or very charismatic, but as structures get created around that person, then the structures contribute weight to how things happen as well, right? So there's an interplay between them. I think there's partly you have to think about at what time period are you looking at the problem or the situation? Are you looking at the beginning? Are you looking at the end? Are you looking at the middle? And I think that would affect also this question of agency versus structure.
All right, so moving along, I think a terrific question. We haven't fully answered it. But the next big vote getter is by Ben Mazzotta. Ben, I'll read it, but then if you want to modify it given discussion, you may do so. How can we determine whether NGO structure causes success or the consequence of another variable? Is it that the NGOs with broad grassroots bases correctly identify influential norms, or is it that their communications influence grassroots actors? And if I could just editorialize for a moment, this is a very general issue with respect to research methods in studying the effects of social networks. When can you figure out that something's being caused by the network versus just the fact that if you're an important person, you end up being very central in the network, or maybe that if you're very successful, you end up with that corner office, and that's why you get the central network, and there's sort of another variable causing both. This is just endemic in the field, and it's been wrestled with varying success, sometimes also just ignored. As well. So, Wendy, do you want to address
that? Yeah, I mean, this is something I've thought about for a really long time, and it's a really good question. I don't have a really good answer to that, right? Because even if you look at something like sanctions, I mean, there's an intermediating factor, that's the states, right? States have to choose to act on these ideas. So, the way I would answer that is, well, why did they choose the ideas that they did? Okay, so, somewhere in there, some NGO is advocating those four rights, and those four rights just happen to show up in almost two-thirds of the economic sanctions we see based on human rights. And I went through this really quickly at the end. So that, to me, it's not proof positive, right? But it does demonstrate that, okay, there's a tendency that states are following this line of advocacy. So the counterfactual would be, if Amnesty advocated different rights, maybe we'd see different outcomes in terms of sanctions. And this is part of the difficulty of studying things like norms. What is a standard? How do we know if it's a standard, right? And sometimes standards are contested, right, as David studies in his work, and in that case, is it really a standard, right? What is it? So I think that's a really good question. In terms of the grassroots identifying influential norms, I would say no, that it's not identifying, it's creating the norms, right? That these organizations that have both grassroots membership and centralized agenda setting and rulemaking power within certain actors are not finding norms, but they're taking ideas and making them normative. Right? They're more effective at creating these widely held standards than other types of organizations. So it's not that they're figuring out the world better, it's that they're creating what we think about as human rights. And then some other organization can come along and challenge that, but they've already set the agenda, right? They've already said, these are the four rights we care about, this is what human rights are, this is what states are gonna act on, and anyone who wants to add to that is gonna have to take that into account, right? So I think that's, I know that's not a satisfying answer, we can talk about it later, but I really do think that this is, as David said, a fundamental problem with studying ideas, more broadly speaking.
If anyone else wants to comment. I wanted a little experiment here in terms of, which is I think apropos exactly the topic here. How many people are actually online, sort of able to post questions? I'm just this is one of those access issues. Raise your hand high. I'm just trying to get a sense of who's excluded from the discussion. Well, maybe what I'll do now is take a question from those folks who aren't plugged in. If I might, Stephen?
Yeah, Steve Helfer. I work at the Law School Libraries International Section. There was an interesting op-ed in the New York Times on the 28th, whereby a Columbia professor hypothesized that one of the reasons we haven't seen any kind of rioting in these economic times, at least not in the United States, is partially because everyone is so atomized by our technological advances, so to speak. And I particularly wanted to address Professor Wong, I think, because you said one of the reasons to go to an NGO was to get information, but if information is so widely diffused, that's going to remove one of those reasons. Likewise, one of the reasons to go to a library is to get information, but if everyone can get information in his own dorm room, no face-to-facing. So I'm curious about, in some ways, technology does not seem to be helping mass movements, but hurting that.
I'm not going to address the technology part per se, but I think that you're making an excellent point, right? Which is that there are a lot of human rights NGOs out there, or environmental NGOs, or whatever you happen to care about. How do you know who to choose, right? That's essentially what I'm understanding to be your question.
Well, no, you were talking about information being a
right. So how do you know which NGOs producing information that you can trust?
No, but
right?
well, to some degree, but if you can get your information so easily online, why even bother joining
right,
the NGO?
Right, because there are various sources of information on human rights. For example, you have Human Rights Watch, you have Amnesty. You know, you can look at Doctors Without Borders. You can look at Human Rights First. I mean, there are lots and lots of different sources for it. So part of your question is, where does this reputation for trust come from? How can I trust your information, which would then lead me to join your NGO, either as a member volunteering or as a monetary contributor? Right? That's what you're asking. How do you choose? I think that's a really difficult question to answer without thinking about, well, how is it that NGOs brand themselves and establish a reputation? Right? And that's something I'm interested in thinking about. I mean, how is an NGO credible? And part of the reason why human rights NGOs have established credibility and how they've done that is through the soundness of their research. So if it's found out that they're saying that, you know, people are being tortured in X state and it turns out that they're not, then you have a real credibility problem, right? So in order to use an information shortcut like joining a network to get cheap information, you have to believe that information. And if you can't believe that information, then you're right. You're left with five or six different choices and not much reason to choose one over the other.
But why join if the information is so cheap and readily
available? Well, because some of it's not as reliable as others. I think that's my answer.
Let me also just jump in to link this to sort of ideas around collective action. You know, sort of the classic idea of Mansour Olson is one of the reasons why you have movements emerge, is that there are organizations that offer selective, are able to exclude people from some of the benefits of being a member of the organization. So it's true that in the irony of the information age, that's harder to exclude people from getting information from your organization than it used to be. On the other hand, to the extent that information actually influences things, like influences how people see the world, it offers a great opportunity for organizations to amplify their impact, to have, let's say, satellite pictures of Sudan and saying, look at these villages being devastated. There's also the interesting question in terms of the atomization issue. Of course, here's the whole question of bowling alone. Are we all bowling alone more than we used to? And maybe that inhibits collective action in some fashion per Bob Putnam. It's an interesting question because I'll throw out a question to the crowd. How many people would say, if you counted up the number of people that you have had substantive exchanges with today, you thought about the number of face-to-face exchanges you've had, will have had by the end of the day? Maybe you can take yesterday, since you've already experienced yesterday and you have data on that. How many exchanges you've had that have been electronically mediated, not counting telephone, but let's say email or instant messaging or the like. How many of you have had more exchanges mediated by electronic means? Okay. And how many face-to-face? So we see which way things are going. But I think one of the interesting things is is, I mean, this isn't shocking, but I think that I'm sure if we talked to people from 10 years ago, first of all, it would have been quite a different distribution, but also people would have been interacting with fewer people. This is one of the things that amazes me, like with my, talk about my teenage daughter, but at 11 o'clock when I'm trying to get her, you know, so you need to go to sleep and, you know, you get up early for high school and so on, she's communicating with her friends because, you know, there's no way when I was her age that I could have been talking to my friends at 11, 11:30 at night. We sort of have this contagion of insomnia, I think, among teenagers. But they're able, in some sense, put a more positive gloss on it, to connect with their friends at all hours of the day, and to connect with more people than they have been. So I'm skeptical of the sort of atomization hypothesis. Now the question of affiliations and how that's structured, that's another story. But I mean, clearly technology enabled, just to take the Obama campaign, facilitated movement and mobilization of resources, combined with a certain utilization of that technology that would not have been possible just a few years ago. So
can I just say too that I think in the next panel we'll be talking about this more. When you think of identity or narratives that shape identities, I know lots of people who go to bookstores instead of buying on Amazon because it's part of their identity to go to bookstores and contribute to their local community and to buy a physical product instead of getting something delivered to their Kindle. And the same way that I know people who subscribe to Human Rights Watch pay some nominal fee to get reports that they could get online for free anyway because it's a part of their identity to associate themselves with this organization.
I'd also say that technology, you know, a lot of people join NGOs often because they want to change the world, and technology reduces barriers to entry, so it makes it very easy for people to participate in that. And I send money to Human Rights Watch because I want Human Rights Watch to change things, and the internet, I donate over the internet because that's the only way I really donate to anything. But it's, you know, people don't just join Human Rights Watch to get the inside scoop on human rights abuses. They do it because they want to stop those abuses, and the internet makes it easier. You know, reduces the friction for all those kinds of interactions and affiliations happen.
But they also believe that Human Rights Watch is doing something.
Yes.
Right? They choose.
Partly because of the reports that we do.
Right. But, I mean, right, exactly. But they're choosing over four or five alternatives, right? Because there is some sort of reputation that Human Rights has established, whether there's technology or not.
Can't quite read your name.
Oh, Doris. I had my buddy here put up a thing, but basically, I'm interested. I come from the Harvard Law School Development Office, and we're all into fundraising, and we talk about this big triangle. Half of the money comes from the top third or fourth of the triangle, and then lots and lots of gifts, making up maybe over half of what we get, come from the base. And I'm more interested in the base, how things happen from the bottom up, and I think, what you're talking about has to do with, to me, all the big international NGOs and what's going on up there. And I'm desperately wanting to connect up with the local and have some real effect down here. Does your studies go into like how, say, the green movement, how it's like percolated up from the bottom? In Central Square, Cambridge, there's an organization called Greenport. And it's a bunch of neighbors who got together, just haphazardly crashed together like 2 years ago, and they have this huge, they've got all this stuff percolating, all these groups forming, they're doing things in the neighborhood. And I think, you know, they say think globally, act locally, but I'm thinking it's more, it should be think locally and act locally and connect up globally to synergistically have a an unbroken connection, and I'm having trouble making the local connections. I need to hear about how I can make those local connections so I'm not wasting all this time, I'm not plowing through 10 million things on the web, I mean, trying to find my connections, but how do I like leverage what's there now with the web and be really really good at like quickly getting to what I want to do, plugging in for how much I want to, unplugging out when I need to, and just like doing what I need to do to be the most robust, connected in person I can be in any domain, whether it's human rights or the green movement or whatever. That's the best I can do on that. So take it away.
It's a great question. I'm grappling with it. But I'll let my panelists, who I'm sure have pithy answer.
Doesn't have to be pithy. Just give me what you know.
Can I just say, to follow up, I mean, one of the questions, maybe a meta question to that and other questions, is how much can be operationalized? I mean, that was sort of scientist's edge and say, I can't provide this as you know, the thing that we know just before we take action. But can we take action? And I know, too, David mentioned this debate between Watts and Gladwell, and then Watts has, he works for Yahoo, right? He has a lab where they're actually trying to operationalize insights from social network analysis. I don't think there are social network analysts working at the major human rights NGOs, but maybe they should hire a Yahoo research service. You know, I just don't know, I don't know the extent to which one could, even before you answer a specific question about tactics, can you generally answer questions about tactics?
Yeah, I mean, certainly from, you know, one of the goals of sociology as a discipline, going back to James Coleman, has been, you know, institutional design. You know, is there a way in which we can generate structures that optimize certain kinds of outcomes, right? And networks has become, you know, in ways it's fetish, but also, you know, there's a deep insight there, and partly what we're connecting to in this idea of always speaking close is this idea that these sort of interconnections can be structured in a certain way to produce outcomes. So in the experiment that I didn't talk about, one of the goals of the experiment is to say, well, if you have a certain outcome, like you want to diffuse, difference between diffusing HIV/AIDS across the population versus diffusing condom use across the population. Those might be different kinds of contagions, right? So if you want to diffuse condom use, maybe you actually want to target different kinds of networks, that's a strategic incentive, but also you may want to structure different kinds of networks, especially if you have communities you can manipulate like you can online. And in fact, just as a footnote, so this experimental design is really just meant to do basic research, but you know, I did this while I was at Harvard, and they patented the stupid thing. Right, because you know, as soon as they thought there was an idea of controlling behavior, the idea was maybe we can make some money with this, which I doubt it, honestly. But there's always this eye to whether or not you can control these things. I think it's very much like what you're looking at Yahoo. You know?
Just to one more point to that, Cass Sustein in his book Nudge, he sort of tries to talk something about what you were just, I believe, talking about, where you try to structure a bunch of out of all the millions of choices you can make, you sort of structure it to give the best, cream off the best, and give those to people to choose between.
I thought the book was Nudge.
Nudge, I'm sorry. Nudge.
No, I'm kidding.
I don't know.
I'm kidding.
Nudge,
I'm kidding.
Nudge.
I'm kidding.
Whatever.
I'm kidding about that. There was one thing I wanted to throw out there on this sort of local system question that you raised, which is sort of thinking about, at least in my view, and I'll be interested in other people commenting on this, and how the Obama campaign, you know, had a, you know, that both enabled people with a shared interest who were scattered across the country to work towards some common goal, but also facilitated, and in part built on local networks, local relationships, and facilitated the creation of local relationships through you know, people coming together in houses to make phone calls. And you've seen this, it's, you know, since the campaign as well as efforts, and I'm curious, you know, how effective this has been, through efforts of people coming together in house parties to talk, or wherever you want to call it, to talk about what might be, you know, the big issues of the day and where the movement should go. And so there was an interesting question, and there, I mean, there was, it was more the sort of act, I mean, it was sort of act locally and globally and think globally. It wasn't really about thinking, it wasn't about thinking about local problems that were truly idiosyncratic as much as thinking about the global situation and how you might intervene to change that. But I do think that that was an example of an architecture that had some of the features that you were talking about. I don't know.
Maybe I'll just briefly comment on these last two questions, because they actually have something in common. I think it's perplexing us on the panel, in part because these are really hard questions. And the digital age is very, very new. And the disembedding of face-to-face relations and the attempt to reconstitute them virtually I mean, we can pretend that we understand what's going on, but none of us have. We're in the middle of a process that we can get, we can partly glimpse it from within the process, but it'll be a task for later social historians to figure out what exactly happened in this age. And I think that we see both promise and peril in these new technologies. We don't know the extent to which they can be replacements for the face-to-face movements that you were talking about, sir. We don't know whether or not how we're going to actually integrate them with the local dynamics of the face-to-face, like you're saying. In some ways, it's still an experiment, and people are trying to make connections between virtual communities and real communities. And you know, I for one, I don't pretend to know how that's going to turn out. I think that the question of you could imagine that you can get groupthink transnationally in a way that you never could have before. And you could lose the effective relationships that actually motivate people to action on a local level. That would be a terrible thing for politics. You could also imagine, though, on the opposite, which David was saying about the Obama campaign, that if one of the things that makes action on a local level work well is that the agency of a group is easy to understand because you understand that you're not acting alone, but you're acting with others, and the relevant thresholds that determine outcomes can then be grasped by everybody. You say, I know that we together can build this house if we all pitch in, and I see that other people are involved, I want to be part of the efficacious set of actors, I go get involved. Can the internet do the same thing for us transnationally or beyond the local? That's a big question. I think that the optimistic scenario would say, yeah, if I know that we're going to raise $1 million for the Obama campaign at 5:30 today, and it happens once or twice, and people realize you can get cooperation among lots of people who are don't have face-to-face reactions, relations, then you're leveraging some of the benefits of the face-to-face community. Whether that's going to be enough to replace local action, I think my suspicion is no. And I think it's very important that we think hard about how the virtual world isn't like the face-to-face world, even as we try and bring the best aspects of the face-to-face world into the virtual world. So I think some of the reason why you're not getting immediate responses is that these are very deep questions about the sociology of human relations and about digital networking, and I for one don't have the answers, but I share your puzzle.
Thank you. So a quick reaction from Wendy, and then we will bring it to a close.
And there's this awful term in international relations called globalization, but I think it really points to this idea that it's both, everything's both local and global, right? So all these international NGOs, as you point out, are top down. They're international, so by definition, they're much more vague and universal. And I think that best of those and the ones that are truly committed to democratic ideals, which is not all human rights NGOs, will try to localize these universal themes. So just in talking to a lot of different levels of Amnesty leaders, for example, one of the things they struggle over is how do we maintain the same message in different parts of the world so that it resonates with our members in Egypt as well as it does our members in the UK. And that is a fundamental struggle that requires both a universal message from the center and then some local people to actually apply it, to make it work, as in the Obama campaign, right? In the Obama campaign, you had national level mobilizers along with local state parties out there campaigning for Obama, using similar messages, but of course tailored to a particular district in Florida or a particular state, right? So I think it's definitely interactive, and I think that just because we have all these universalizing technologies and these structures that allow for rapid dissemination of the same message doesn't mean that you still have to have that local intermediary, or else it doesn't make sense across different cultures or different states or different cities.
I think this is a wonderfully accurate, ambiguous note to end on. I'm afraid my panelists did not manage to eliminate all the confusion from the room, but I do think that confusion is actually a productive mental state. So in any case, with that, I believe there's food in the back of the room, and thank you for coming. So.